The subject for the evening talk is the experience of insight meditation. Since arriving here, there had been a number of basic meditation instructions and certain kinds of threads and themes which weave their way through the day. And just in the space of 2 days, you're possibly becoming familiar with some of them. And they include acknowledgement and connection with the major postures of life, sitting, walking, standing, reclining. They include the importance of a clear and balanced relationship to the here and now, so that we can not only see the present well and clearly, but also in a balanced, clear way, look at events of past or what might be in the future. We've also spoken of the value and importance of developing the capacity to focus our attention, to give attention to immediacy of things. That's reflected in giving attention to walking on the earth, taking one step at a time. It's reflected in the mindfulness of breathing. And in the process of the postures and the meditations, we sometimes can forget how much of it all is reflection, a kind of metaphor, in fact, for many other circumstances of our daily life. So that, in fact, in just coming into a sitting and one's relationship to a 45-minute period might be a clear demonstration of how we approach many, many other areas of our life. That can show itself in the posture, it can show itself in when we come in to sit, what we are in terms of the beginning period of a sitting. Some people will come into the meditation hall here and within over 5 or 10 or 15 minutes spend a third of the sitting period trying to find the right posture. Nothing feels quite right. And are very, very slow to get into something. And that can be a reflection of numerous other situations. Another person, it might be the latter period of the sitting, the last third of the sitting, in which one is waiting for the end of the period to come. And one can't wait for it to be over. One didn't believe in God before the retreat, took no interest in Judaism, and finds oneself praying for it to be over with, etc. So all of this can be going on in the sittings in terms of beginning, middle, and end. And it's been rather nice to see, in fact, an increasing degree of settling in taking place today. Sometimes yesterday morning, and other times and during some of the sittings, that when Charles or I, Stephen, rang the bell, believe me, the exodus out of here was faster than your noble ancestors from Egypt. It just, whoa. So sometimes things are taking place and one is wishing for something to be over with, to get away from, in the looking at the relationship to that. Yes, of course, we are interested in calmness and clarity, but also in that awareness which really does see and really does take notice of what is our relationship to beginnings, what's our relationship to middle periods of things, what's our relationship to completions and endings, and the kind of patterns which show in our life, not always, but quite often, will be a mirror image, in fact, of what's actually going on in our day-to-day life. All too easily, we can divert our focus from that kind of attention and put it down to blaming the body, put it down to, well, it's the wrong time of the day for me to meditate, putting it down to, well, this is the way that I am, and so forth. the generalizations that we have about ourselves and who we are can really stop and slow up the chance and opportunity to really see, well, as far as the inner life and tendencies go, who we really are, what we are really like. And it's not always easy for us to acknowledge and admit to ourselves some of the patterns, some of the feelings, and some of the thoughts. And one remains eternally grateful that our society hasn't produced a video camera for the mind yet, because some of the things that go on in the mind and meditation hall, one would hate to have them blown up on a big screen behind one here. So it seems like in the inner life, in the process of the meditations, that it can seem like a certain private world that goes on. And we sit in here, or we engage in the walking or standing meditation, and we think to ourselves, well, nobody knows what's going on inside of me. Nobody knows the feelings and the thoughts, or the lack of them that's there. And it all can seem like a privatized world. But perhaps life isn't as private as we like to think. And that, in fact, who we are is that we are, in fact, a kind of walking advertisement for ourselves, or a sitting advertisement, you might say, insofar that if there are tendencies of the mind, beautiful and ugly, appreciative and questionable, or whatever, that does get manifested. That does show itself. Other people do see. And sometimes, as we know all too well in this world, some people in life see us far more clearly than we see ourselves. And all the awarenesses, one feature, therefore, of the awarenesses which arise is looking at the movements of the unsatisfactory tendencies. Looking and acknowledging as part of the experience of the insight meditation, of noticing especially some of the unsatisfactory tendencies which go on. One of the very common features of the unsatisfactory tendencies, as we know very well, is the judgmental mind. And in the judgmental mind, as distinct from clear awareness and clear judgment, that in the judgmental mind we can sense and know that it's born out of reactivity. If we have enough awareness, we know what is a judgment about something. From being judgmental, which carries with it an accumulation, a pressure from the past, entering into the present and spilling out anywhere and everywhere. And there are certain words and names in this world that one only has to mention the word for some people and there's already a reaction, already a negativity, already a fear of. And so that we end up all too easily in life hiding or caught up in or identified with the judgmental mind around the label. And that's common just everywhere. People can't see each other. One has the situations here, we know only too well in the Middle East, one has the parallel situations in Northern Ireland. Just mention certain groups, mention certain names, and there's a reaction already, judgment already. May never be any contact with, may never be any association with. Where does this negative judgmental conditioning come from? Just as it happens in the scale of groups and nations and people struggling to be a nation or whatever it might be, similarly, obviously, easily can happen with ourselves and with people who are around us. And you and I, in the judgmental mind, something can happen from the near or distant past which has affected us. We're sitting in the meditation, we're walking in the meditation, it suddenly comes up, that hurt, that pain, that disappointment, that invasion, that intrusion, or whatever the expression of it there. And we feel it, we feel the movement, we feel the formation, the state of mind which arises with it, the negative judgment of the mind. And then we start to indulge in it. We feed it, we support it, we justify it. We go to our memory in other places, in other circumstances, and we build up we become the judge, the prosecutor, the jury, the executioner, all in one 45-minute period. And then we say, I'm practicing to be in touch with reality. So things do arise. And some of you have been reporting in the small groups today, in the one-to-one I just had earlier, and other times as well, as you see it yourself. One can't organize what the quality of the meditation will be. We don't have any idea. We know we can have one lovely, sweet meditation in which we experience in that we're knocking on the doors of nirvana or whatever. We fully anticipate that in leaving the room and in coming back in here, the doors will burst open. And then we find that we remember our husband or our children or the government or whatever. And all this great clarity and wisdom and the doors of nirvana have opened and it's hell. And again, no absolute assurance in any way what goes on in the experience of just sitting and being with ourselves. And we're finding or working, if I'm struggling at times, what is the wisdom to deal with situations well? And for that, we can't rely on the old mind. We can't rely on it. And we keep imagining that all the views and the negativities or the agitation or the anger which is arising inside of us about whatever it might be will be resolved through perpetuating the belief, through consolidating the viewpoint, through keep going over it again and again, like those poor suffering rats and mice in laboratories going round and round the wheel again, not being able to get off it. Sometimes that's what we face in the meditation hall. Why? It's in the mind. And therefore, it's also what we can face and be exposed to in daily life. Some of you will know the situation of seemingly being pushed back and forwards between very strong, intense feelings about something or other, and then isolation from being cut off, not having any feeling, or feeling rather cold and dry, and going backwards and forwards between the two, running in conflict between one and the other. Some imbalance is there. Something's at the state of dis-ease in some way or other. And it can easily happen that for those, as an example of what I mean, who are in very cerebral professions, who spend their day facing the computer screen, who are buried in literature morning, noon and night, who live in a world of words again and again, and all that goes with it, might be so involved in the theory of existence, in the words about whatever it might be, and not be in touch with much else of themselves, and then come home, and in coming home, no feeling of connection with one's children, with one's spouse, partner, with anything. The only amount of energy that one's got left inside of oneself is to turn the television on, and there's no energy left to switch it off. And this kind of situation, in a way, reflects and shows the heart itself is in a desert. And as human beings, we have a danger that we become increasingly more arid, increasingly more dry, and increasingly more heartless. One of the ways that the absence, the lack of feeling can show itself, of course, also, when we use the word mindfulness here, the word is rather interchangeable with the word heartful. Mindful, heartful. Heartful, mindful. So it can be that in our meditation, sitting, walking, standing, sometimes, of course, just mindfully walking up and down can seem very ordinary, absolutely nothing special whatsoever. But also, if we can just find a little quality of sensitivity there. Just cultivate a little sensitivity, just for a few steps, just to walk rather quietly and sensitively on this earth. Just for a few steps in the day can make an immense amount of difference. Sometimes in the midst of a sitting period, just to open out our awareness and acknowledge and recognize the difficulties, the pains, the struggles of what people are going through here, who we don't know, who've never seen before in our life. We don't know their history, their family history, their health issues, the crisis that can be arising in life. We don't know with each other how many moments, days, hours we have left in this world, and so forth. And sometimes it's just beautiful just to sit and just to open and expand out the awareness in a heartful way and say, hey, we're the living generation. Hey, we're the people of the earth. And just to open and acknowledge those kind of moments so that it's not a dry run practice. It's not a habitual, oh my goodness, yet another sitting meditation, yet another walking meditation, and that kind of sluggish, heavy, apathetic, habitual attitude that can set in. And you say, hey, let me open out the awareness. Let me expand for a few moments and feel the togetherness, the silence, the presence of things. All of that expresses and demonstrates the sweetnesses of life. In the teachings, in the practices which take place in the Vipassana tradition, it speaks of, or it's been spoken of regularly, various characteristics of existence, not the absolute reality of existence, characteristics of existence, features of existence. And it's our responsibility, really, and our duty, in a way, to find and explore the commitment to them, and we'll be able to work with them. And one of them, easy, common enough, and that is of impermanence, of change. And in the experience of impermanence or of change, how much of our relationship to life is directly related to our peace of mind, our happiness, our joy, our sorrow and our sadnesses, our ups and our downs, is in relationship to the way that we relate to change. And here in these kind of practices, if quite often in conventional religious world, faith and beliefs, there's a difference between the two, but I'll talk about that another time, that if in a religious world, as well, in a secular world, faith and belief matters a great deal, then certainly features here would be mindfulness or awareness, and the capacity, sense of that awareness, one feature is to be able to see the appearance and acknowledgement of change. And in that recognition and acknowledgement of change which takes place, as we see already, that in that acknowledgement, again, it's the experience that occurs of things in life coming and going. And to some degree, our wisdom in life is how well we can deal with comings and goings. And in that, again, though we are obsessed with the language of choice, much of what really matters in life, actually, there's not much choice about. And so easily the language of choice is a kind of escape route for the self to avoid working with that which doesn't give us much choice. From the obvious things, birth, aging, pain arising, death, that the manifestation, the movement, the process of all of that matters considerably to each and every one of us, because we are human beings, we have a physical aspect and feature to ourselves, and therefore that movement, that rhythm, that cycle is something which we all have to face and deal with. And that means, can we learn to be witnessing and connecting with and understand this movement very, very well, because if we don't, we will suffer, period. And sometimes people point out regularly and frequently enough in the aging process. Outwardly, one sees the changes which are going on with each and every one of us. Inwardly, heart and mind can feel the same as 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, half a century ago. The body is giving one message to the world. The inner life is giving another. The inner life might feel very young and fresh, and life is just beginning and underway. And the body says, oh no, it isn't. Decades are going by, years are going by. We have to live with the fact of both. How the heart and mind is in its relationship to the world, but equally how the body is in its relationship to the world. And all the outlook and attitude that goes along with it, might, and care and respect for the body, etc., exercise and all of that, still doesn't stop moment to moment change, and therefore moment to moment aging. Just recently I went to have lunch with a very dear friend and fine benefactor of the Dharma, Morris Ash, who's 79 years of age, and who's has a lovely home which is made available for friends, very fine 18th century Palladian house, huge estate, etc., etc. And his leg, the muscles had stopped briefly in the leg while in that local high street, and he fell over, straight over on his face, rather painful. A few months ago he lost an eye, and we were speaking about the aging process, and in the main center staircase of the house, very, very bad place, the physiotherapist said to him, do you have any stairs in your home? And he has this huge flights of stairs in this large place. And then said, well, if you walk up and down the stairs with taking the first leg and strengthen the leg. And I said to him, well, Morris, are you doing it? He said, I have to go up the stairs, of course. And he said to me, and then he said, with all seriousness, he says, I don't do any exercise, he said. I never did. He said, it's very bad for your health. And he's 79 years old, and he's quite a lovely person. So sometimes there is this desire. Some of us love exercise and do plenty of it, and so forth. But the point I'm trying to make, with or without the exercise, with or without our connections, there, bodily life goes on, it processes, and it ages, and it goes from moment to moment. And no amount of cosmetics, no amount of surgery, no amount of hair colouring, and no amount of all the other things that we might think of and use can obscure the actuality that's going on from moment to moment. That's it. And if we can give some quality of time, care and attention to that, then we won't be living in the past. We won't be living in the terrible mantra of I remember when. And how for young people especially, hearing their grandparents come out with the I remember when is, oh my God, here we go, etc. There. So as a great act of compassion for one's grandchildren, as well as for oneself, in all of this, here and now, moment to moment, and finding the wisdom that way. Otherwise the tendency is that when people are not living very well in the present, and not very clear in the present, the tendency easily in the aging process is to elevate the past, make it better. And you know as well as better than anybody on this earth the fiction of that kind of thinking, that it doesn't stop the mind going back, and I remember when we learned. So the movement with time, and keeping current and present, is really an act of wisdom itself, so that we're extraordinarily aware when the thought and the language and the speech turns to the past, which has its appropriateness. We're extraordinarily aware when we're going to the future, and we're even more aware when we're going to the future 1 year, 2 years, 3 years ahead. And everything inside of one itself ought to be saying, that's a provisional statement. That might be what happens. that might be the way things unfold or whatever. And there's no room in these kind of teachings from the standpoint of insight either to be caught up in optimism or in pessimism, just states of mind, but to be as clear with the future, as provisional about it, because the future comprises of multiple events and we are just one figure in the multiplicity of events. And if we think we're in charge of our future, we are naive. Multiple things occur, for something to occur, we can make a contribution to it. So in our awarenesses here, in our practices here, in our meditations here, it's not only an opportunity for us to ground ourselves here and now, but correspondingly have a balanced relationship to past, present and future. These are the three fields of time in which you and I have our life and our being. Can we get this clear enough with ourselves and, in fact, with each other? Each time we're mindful of the breath, we're mindful of the occurrence of things called breath coming and going. Each time we see a thought, it comes and it goes. Each time we experience a body sensation, it comes and it goes. Our very life comes and it goes. So the capacity to attend well and in a reasonably sustained way, so something runs clear about it, not making it ultimate truth, absolute reality, or anything like that, but we just want that awareness of change, of impermanence, to run deep enough that when events come and go in our life, we clear, hey, that's what living is. That's what we experience of living. Change, fluctuation, movement, anticipated and unanticipated, expected and unexpected, that's the fact of human experience. And all of our moaning and groaning and complaining and agitation doesn't actually do anything for us and nothing for existence. So in that respect, many small situations here can just be incredibly helpful just to give us a reminder. And that can equally be in the meditation room here, where sometimes things are not as one would wish, obviously. One comes in, someone turns the cooling system on, someone turns it off, it becomes musical chairs, or whatever. You come in and someone is sitting much closer to you, or stretches themselves and kicks you in the back, or starts picking their nose, which is not your favorite form of observation, or whatever it might be. All of that goes on. There can be initially some movement that goes on inside. Can we learn just to observe, to see something occur, not grasp on it, not use it as a judgmental reference point later on in the day, to say, this is what goes on in life. People do pick their nose. People do turn on and turn off things. People do act speedily and act slowly. And human beings have been doing this ever since, whenever. And, of course, the Buddhists will say, actually, it's the same crowd who are doing it, so they keep getting reborn, so whatever. So, whatever the view that one might have, whether it was others or just us in different cycles, it doesn't matter too much, but nevertheless it keeps going on. And we can spend a whole lifetime trying to get other people around us to behave properly so we can have peace of mind. Haven't we learned at the age that we can't get peace of mind through controlling other people? People will not fit into this requirement. And the meditation hall and the walking hall and the eating hall and the sleeping room is a constant reminder to us that the lives of others are not made to fit in with us. Life fits in with life. Life lives with life. It doesn't fit the whim, the wants, the desires of the self. If we understand this alone in life, we've conquered the problem of life. We genuinely understand that the lives of others, and even our physical life, even our mental life, just doesn't fit in with the desires and the wantings of the self. We can't reduce life to what I want. And the teachings remind us of this so again, again, and again, and every little demonstration on this retreat, of which there are tens of thousands of them, is to remind us of the simple truth: life will not fit in with one's whims. Why? Because it's not made for you, not made for me. It's made out of itself. It springs out of itself. It comes out of itself. It's living out of itself. And we are like waves on the oceans, demonstrations of it. Nobody can control this existence. Thank goodness. It's our saving grace that nobody, no vulgar, tyrannous, merciless human being, and no great bodhisattva or Buddha or whatever has got control over the expressions of existence and humanity. And you see and understand that well. You understand the fluctuations and the changes and the movements and the expressions. And we respond to some and we let go of others and we accept things and we work for change, etc. But we know something. We know that in the deepest place of our being, we can't control the existence. We can walk out hall in here in the night, and we can look up at the miracle and the marvellousness of the night sky, and can sense and feel the vastness and the spaciousness of all of this, and we say, my goodness, all those little events of the day, they all fit into something much greater. They all rest in something much greater, and perhaps that's the function of the moon and the stars, the sky and the earth, is to remind us that all this fits into something bigger. If we don't get that sense, we'll live a very small-minded mind life, a very narrow little view, terribly judgmental, constantly complaining, and no peace. Because we forgot to look at the night sky. So all this belongs to, part of, connected with, experience of insight, meditation, and therefore any degree of intelligence. In that, in the characteristic feature of impermanence, we see too, with all of that, there's something peculiar about it with regard to our relationship. Sometimes we look at impermanence and we think, thank goodness. Naturally, whatever. We've gone through a difficult health period and we've recovered from it. We've been grateful for contemporary medicine or alternative medicine or natural healing processes. And much healing, incidentally, the body goes on in environments such as this marvelous, almost miraculous kind of healing. And tell you many, many stories of healings that have gone on because of sitting posture, walking posture, and change of energy flows, genuinely. Blind have been come to see in these retreats, the deaf have come to hear in these retreats, people who, blind have come to see, deaf come to hear, and teachers have become to speak closer to the microphone in these retreats, and all sorts of other miracles have occurred. And sometimes the energy and focus and that little bit more awareness that comes to us makes a change, makes a difference. And all of that's part of these kind of environments and situations in which we are participating in. But, as I said, the relationship to change and impermanence, sometimes it's gratitude, appreciation, relief. Sometimes it's delight and enjoyment enjoyment with. We love that dynamic sense of life. We don't want it to be stagnant and still and kind of unchanging in a dormant kind of way. And so that we appreciate the dynamic thrusts and diversity of existence. Well, we should. And at other times, we look at impermanence, and with it can come loss, sorrow, and regret. And what the same thing which gave us so much joy and pleasure in life, and we're so grateful for its arising, can be such that we can feel terrible disappointment at its dissolution. And sometimes we have it completely the other way around, and we think something which was terrible that has happened to us, which we last thing that we ever wanted to have happened to us in our life, and there's been a change, and we, my goodness, we're really grateful for that. And I've had enough contact and communications with people on retreats and outside of them with life-threatening illnesses, young people in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, as well as older people, and who have said without any wavering and consistently that they're very glad for their cancer, very glad for their HIV, very, very glad for their MS, or whatever it might be. One thinks, my goodness, the capacity of the human spirit to transcend its difficulties is quite remarkable. And some have said, it took this to start waking me up. It took something intense to make me look at existence. And I mean it, not just saying it in a high moment. It's a consistent statement. So with awareness and observation and seeing interchange, facts too, as I said, looking, how am I in a field of change, inwardly and outwardly, at any kind of level, so that we don't get pulled and pushed around by movement. Even in my short visits here in over the past three years, you know, I haven't been anywhere in Israel. When I come to this country, I only see one thing, basically the mind of Israelis. And I've seen enough in the 3 years because of geographic situations and others, as you will know far better than I, that there have been a period of optimism in the air, that long-standing resolute conflicts could be resolved, people can coexist, and have seen change, as you and I have known, and seen, of course, an awful assassination, an invasion in southern Lebanon, and all this, that and the other, and the feelings of optimism and pessimism come up and down in the fluctuations of these situations. And they're not easy for any of you or any of us to live and know and deal with. Can we be consistent in our awareness? Can we be consistent in our concerns? Can we keep clarity and presence alive with us, even when the mood of the nation is going up and down because of events? Otherwise, we just tie ourselves in, we limit ourselves in such a way that we lose vision, we lose confidence, we lose the sense of interconnectedness on fluctuations of mind state, up and down, up and down. And that's where the equanimity and the steadiness matters for us, and it matters for those who live close to us. Teachings, practices, experiences of insight meditation keep reminding us of this and keep pointing to this again and again, so that we don't forget that in our interconnectedness, the welfare of others is our welfare. Our welfare is for the welfare of others. One can't have one without the other. Period. And so you see here, the hall is a demonstration of global life. The day is a demonstration of humanity. Much more subtle, yes. Much more refined, yes. Much less gross than those fighter jets passing over during the day, yes. But nevertheless, it's still humanity, still working, finding ways to cooperate. And one sees, and plenty of you have expressed some recognition during the time that we've been here, of the immense number of kindnesses and gestures and warmth, actions of support, beautiful things in many ways coming out of people's hearts here, giving each other time and space. That's what awareness is about. That's the heartfulness at work. That's the mindfulness of each other, which is at work. So we look into impermanence. We see the factors which are unsatisfactory, which can arise around with it. We work diligently with it. And then, and finally, in all of that dynamic, of course, is the arising of the I. the rising of me and mine. Whether it's personal, whether it's family, whether it's social, whether it's the district where you live, or whether it's with regard to the nation state, or whatever it might be.
That when we look and see, when does the I arise?
With the I, when it's arising, is it arising in simple acknowledgement, simple recognition of, or is it something more than? Is there something other that's going on with it, holding, possessing, and all of that? And sometimes, when we come in, and perhaps happens to most of us, when we sometimes come into the meditation hall or whatever, maybe accidentally we tread on somebody's pillow, and or we give them a nudge or whatever, and not intended in any way. Normal lack of mindfulness is that we have. And perhaps we've been the one at that time who's been sitting on that cushion or whatever. And immediately the I and the my arises like a Scud missile. It arises and it zooms up. What does he think he's doing? She thinks she's doing. On my space, on my place, on my, in my area. And with that kind of mind, after a few days, people would be needing visas to cross over this place, because we would all set up our own little individual territory just to dare cross over here, etc. All of that's the product of I and mine. It doesn't exist anywhere. Where is this territorialism that we create in the meditation hall and outside of it? In here. Not on the earth. It's in the minds of human beings. And therefore, can we, in looking at the at our mind there, yes, pay acknowledgement and respect to diversity, to nations, to areas, to the place where we are, as we do in here in the meditation hall, but understand in that acknowledgement is different from possessiveness, from control, from all the narrowness that we get caught up in. Makes life too hard, too difficult, too painful, too much conflict or whatever. So therefore I say, what goes on in here, experience of insight, meditation, experience of practice of awareness, is an extraordinary clear reflection to us of the circumstances on this earth. It's not apart. When people say to me, oh, Christopher, in daily life, this is daily life. Anything that goes on in here, you'll find outside. Anything we find outside, it goes on in here. Might be more refined and more subtle, but it's not different. People are people. We're living together. We're sharing the days together. We're going through things together. And in all of that, if characteristics of existence, of the impermanence of things, the unsatisfactoriness which can arise, it goes with it, and the watching of the eye and the mind, great vigilance about egotism, ego-ness, self-ness, me, I. Great vigilance about that. Maybe we can discover things and the sense of things through the silence, through the ways together, which is actually freeing, clear, and skillful. Ego, I, and mind possessiveness doesn't know skillfulness. It doesn't know conflict resolution. It doesn't know understanding, it doesn't know what it is to be, to connect. But all it knows is I, me, and mine. How can it have any other vision? It's small, it's narrow, it's limited in its way. But we can have to see through all of that. Then there's a possibility, different sense of things. And teachings, as we say repeatedly, keep pointing to that which is free from dependencies on impermanence, free from holding to unsatisfactoriness, free from clinging to I, me, and my, and it brings its own liberating and enlightening wisdom. And that's what will make a difference on the earth. Seeing through egotism. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings see into the nature of things. May all beings live a free and accommodating life. So let's have our couple of quiet minutes together, shall we please?